It is time for the Media Beat from David Tereshchuk, his weekly review of media coverage for Robinhood Radio and exclusive to Robinhood Radio. David is a multimedia and international journalist with his own online column at themediabeat.us. And as a special correspondent since 2012, he has contributed TV reports to the PBS network, mostly on ethical issues. Here's David.
This is David Tereshchuk with the Media Beat for the weekend beginning November 24th, 2023. If you're in a part of the world where this is relevant, I hope you had a good Thanksgiving. For myself, it will probably be no surprise to know that I'm still abroad in Ireland. And still, of course, the war in the Gaza Strip dominates the headlines. The currently reported hard-won pause in hostilities that is to allow prisoner exchanges of mostly women and young people is planned to last just 4 days, with the clock starting last evening, New York time. But it may go on longer if more hostages are released. That's something perhaps to be hoped for. But Israel has vowed that the war continues after the pause, and the head of UNICEF, the UN's children's agency, said that the pause is not enough, that in fact Gaza has now become, and I quote her verbatim, the most dangerous place in the world to be a child. On the media front, this bitter war has sparked and highlighted some decidedly innovative reporting methods. I could mention notably the Washington Post's remarkable digital examination conducted in partnership with the PBS Frontline television team, whose own fuller version will appear on air soon, a detailed examination of just how Hamas managed to pull off its massive surprise attack into southern Israel on October 7th. It's a video presentation, indeed the Post calls it a video analysis, and most of its content does comprise video elements, apart from some all-important audio, interviews evidently done by phone, with Israeli military sources active and retired, as well as security company employees whose technology was supposed to protect Israel. The report combines geolocating techniques and other forms of video dissection as it pieces together, among many different sources, body cam footage recorded by Hamas fighters from the motorbikes they rode for their incursion into Israel, along with material from among the hundreds of video-equipped drones that filled the sky that fateful day. All in all, it presents a compelling account of just how the so-called Iron Wall of Israel's defenses was pierced in around 30 separate breaches. It's a valuable piece of visual journalism, not least for its clear exposé of how crucial a tactic it was for Hamas to disable what Israel was relying on, its high-tech, automated surveillance system. To cite one graphic example, we see a drone dropping grenades onto an elevated, remote-controlled Israeli machine gun emplacement. The Post's narrator tells us the disabling of surveillance points was a tactic known internally within Hamas as the blinding plan. Elsewhere, and more traditionally, we're used to visual war journalism that consists more straightforwardly of images brought to us by a media organization's own photojournalists working in the thick of the action. The New York Times added an arresting twist on this conventional approach by doing its own editorial deconstruction, if you will, or anatomizing even, applying it to an eye-catching picture taken by the photographer Samar Abu Elouf. She is a Gazan herself, with family there too, and she has reported on the territory for The Times since 2021. The newspaper conducts this kind of close examination periodically, presenting it as a special feature that it calls, aptly enough, in one image, and it can often serve as a great aid to readers' fuller understanding of the situation being reported. In this case, Abu Elouf's own exposition, along with some doubtless from her photo editors as well, is provided for the image as a whole and, very tellingly, for details in the picture as well, which are enlarged for special attention. Her photograph was taken in Nasser Hospital, which we can take as emblematic of Gaza's surviving hospitals that still struggle with wounded Palestinians who flooded in for treatment, plus an influx of residents who still believe a hospital could be a place of refuge. This even after the now famous or infamous Al-Shifa Hospital, 20 miles to the north. It was, you'll know, raided by Israeli troops and evacuated by them, either forcibly or in a spirit of cooperation, depending on whichever side we should believe. It's also still a matter of claim and counterclaim over whether or not the Shifa Hospital had hidden beneath it a command and control center for Hamas. At Nasser Hospital in the south, Abu Alouf's photo shows a wounded man lying on the floor, getting attention from medics kneeling around him. Absolute center in the image is the man's upper torso. It's covered with papers, medical forms. A doctor is writing on them, his pen pressing on the man's chest. Over an enlargement of this part of the picture, Abu Alouf's words say, "New arrivals often end up on the floor. Without anything to lean on to take notes, doctors sometimes have little choice but to use the patients themselves." Another detail, slightly off-center, is also enlarged. It's a near-empty, clear plastic bottle with a spray top. Abu Alouf's explanation, which of course we wouldn't know without being told, says, "This bottle does not hold medical-grade disinfectant. The hospital has had to make do with pandemic-era hand sanitizers." At the very edge of the frame, almost unnoticed and slightly obscured by a hospital curtain, are the head and shoulders of another man next to someone else's feet. Abu Alouf's commentary gives the context that she photographed this scene during an evening of Israeli airstrikes. This man, she says, was among those wounded in a residential area. Other words of amplification are displayed over a tight close-up of the first man's head at the picture's center, in which his facial features are considerately hidden by a white surgical glove worn by the doctor. "Those patients who are saved," Abu Alouf summarizes, "cannot expect to stay long at Nasser Hospital. They are quickly discharged into a city in ruins. Every bit of floor space is needed." Altogether, it's a compelling journalistic approach, and it distinguishes this coverage instructively from the general tumult of war photography. You can see the whole sequence at the In One Image part of the New York Times website. Samar Abu Alouf is a winner, a well-deserved winner, I'd say, of the James Foley Award for Conflict Reporting. James Foley, you may sadly remember, is the American multimedia journalist who was held captive while reporting in Syria in 2012, and 2 years later met his death, horrifically beheaded by members of ISIS. His parents set up the award in his memory, and it's given annually by Northwestern University's well-regarded Medill School of Journalism, which was James Foley's alma mater. My reflecting on photographing conflict zones has been prompted, obviously, by current events, but also by the imminent publication in book form of a striking compilation drawn from the work of a longtime colleague and friend, Don McCullen. When his photographs were assembled 5 years ago for an exhibition by the Tate, London's leading museum spaces devoted to modern and British art, Don was hailed as, quote, "our foremost war photographer." The book is called Life, Death, and Everything in Between, a pretty expansive title, you might say. It covers the world, pretty much, too, anywhere at least that there's been a war to report on. I get a personal pang when I see his heart-rending images from places where we were both on assignment, especially Bangladesh, Uganda, and Northern Ireland. After many years, though, there came a period when Don claimed to be weary of war, and he retreated to rural Somerset in southwest England to take landscape pictures. But one truth has to be acknowledged. As the Tate's first curator of photography, Simon Baker, points out in a commentary that is part of the book, Don's ostensibly peaceful landscapes, quote, "offer wild and often bleak accounts of the world around him." And truth be told, Don eventually broke his supposed country idyll to go, because he's unstoppable, I guess, to cover the civil war in Syria. Now and again, Don has ragged on me, sort of seriously, for sneakily escaping from Uganda just before the brutal dictator Idi Amin arrested all the overseas journalists present there, Don included. They were all thrown into Amin's notorious Makindi prison. Several were badly beaten, and they witnessed the killing of many local Ugandan prisoners, often by a mallet crushing their skulls. Several of our colleagues never again worked out in the field, given how traumatized they were. An Africa expert with The Guardian abandoned his long-cultivated specialty and switched to covering education matters within Great Britain. To some degree, I may have appeased Don's apparent annoyance with me for avoiding his fate and that of the others, when several decades later I made a one-hour documentary about him for CBS News. What I may have had to appease was that, frankly, I was in Uganda faithfully following a much more experienced journalist than either of us, David Holden of London's Sunday Times, who advised me something bad might well be about to happen, and I should accompany him as he hurriedly left the country. I never learned what exactly he knew or how, but I was very grateful to have gone with him. Quite separately, 5 years later, David was dead, killed by a bullet through the heart, and his body left in the back streets of Cairo, Egypt. No killer has ever been identified. There have been rumors that Israel's Mossad or even the CIA were involved, but the mystery remains. I suppose Don and I can be counted among our profession's survivors. I revisit these memories now in part to express some gratitude, as I sit in quiet and safe seclusion, for the work done by journalists in dangerous places, and perhaps most especially photojournalists, since they, even more than the rest of us, simply have to get close to the action with all its peril. In closing today, I should report that according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, there are now more than 50 correspondents and media workers among the over 15,000 people who have been killed since the Gaza war began. That's all from the Media Beat for this week. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, David. We will talk to you next week. David can be found at themediabeat.us.